the approach that I've used is just basically to let you tell me a little bit about yourself, how you got where you are, and your interactions, and then gradually as we get into that, you know, better questions occur.
Okay, I came to Michigan State in 1947. I was a graduate student at Yale in the economics when I accepted the post here. I had never heard of Michigan State College. I didn't know where East Lansing was geographically. I had heard of the University of Michigan. I would describe myself as a typical elitist Eastern snob at the time. Okay. I came in part because in 47, as I was exploring employment opportunities, I saw an item on the sports page of Time magazine with a picture of Biggie Munn and Duffy Daugherty, and it said they were leaving Syracuse to revive the football fortunes of Michigan State. And being an athletic fan, I said to my wife, why the hell don't we give it a try? My intellectual orientation, my psychological orientation was to say, essentially, we're going to Indian country. The great unwashed, and maybe we can contribute to civilizing the barbarians. Okay, that was my mindset. I arrived, college had roughly 10,000 students at the time. I picked up the catalog to see if I would recognize any of the names on the faculty. And there at the top I saw John A. Hanna, Bachelor of Science in Poultry. And I said to myself, what the hell did we get into a plow jockey running a university? Right? My first faculty meeting, over which Hanna presided with that deep, mellifluous, authoritative voice, I said, this guy is no plow jockey. Indeed, I was reminded of a statement my father used to make to me all the time. He used to say, you may have a PhD, but you don't have any brains. And I looked at Hanna and I said, this guy may not have a PhD, but he does have brains. So that was my first exposure. The college at the time was in the midst of expansion. The GIs were flooding back from the war. I myself was discharged in 45, and I completed my degree under the GI Bill of Rights by 47. So many of the students I had were actually the same age as I was, mm-hmm. and some of them maybe a touch older than that. The first impression of the campus was an agitated state of disorganized growth. Okay, that's the only way I can describe it. We had an apartment in one of the new brick apartment buildings on Cherry Lane. As a matter of fact, the top half of the building hadn't been bricked up yet when we moved in. There were surplus army barracks for students and some faculty. There were trailers for students, and of course many of them, again given the age factor and the maturity factor, many of them were married. Quonset huts, flat tops, British Empire houses, etc., etc. And again, I asked myself, how come this college out in the sticks had the foresight to provide for all this housing? Well, it was John Hannah who had the idea, moving in to get the surplus property. I mean, this was all Army stuff, you see, mm-hmm. the barracks, which was subdivided into apartments and for both students and faculty, the Quonsets, the flat tops, and so on. That was all surplus Army property, which Hannah had the foresight to obtain for the university. This indeed served as an attraction for both faculty and students to come here, okay, if they were married. The institution at the time had the imprint of emphasis on agriculture on it. The departments that were related to agriculture were good departments. The School of Agriculture, of course, had some preeminence, which I hadn't known about, of course.
Being an elitist.
Being an insufferable Easterner, parochial Easterner. But departments like botany, for example, were a strong department because that related to the raising of crops and so mm-hmm. on. And I was exposed for the first time, largely because of the things that Hannah would say, to this concept of the Land-Grant philosophy. And ideologically, if I can put it that way, I was a Jeffersonian, okay? And it finally occurred to me that the Land-Grant philosophy is indeed a revolutionary in the Jeffersonian sense, a revolutionary concept of higher education, and a revolutionary departure from the European tradition of higher education, which was for the well-born and the advantaged and segments of the population. And indeed, the students we got in those days were still primarily the sons and daughters of members of the working class and the agricultural community. And I developed over the years a fascination for that because this symbolized the notion of opportunity that we always talk about, wave the flag about on the 4th of July. But here it was in the concrete embodiment of what America is supposed to be all about. And these students, of course, came from families where no one had gone to college. Indeed, some of them still with a strong immigrant tradition, you see. The kids out of Hamtramck and so on. And at graduation time, to see the pride of the parents and the families that here one of theirs is getting a university degree. Well, this was John Hannah, you see. These things didn't just happen. He had the vision. He saw that. And while he seldom philosophized in an abstract sense, he was a master pragmatist in administration. For example, the faculty would always raise the question, well, how much are we going to grow? And Hannah said, I don't know. He never gave him a figure, you see. He never gave him a number. He'll say, Why don't we respond to the demand that's out there? And then see what kind of growth is reasonable, whether we can handle it, whether we can handle 15,000. See, we were 10,000 at the time. And when we were at 15,000, they said, well, what about 20,000? Are we going to go beyond 20,000? And he always said, let's wait and see how this thing works out. Okay. And of course, by the time he left in 69, we were over 40,000. Well, in 1947, nobody would have dreamt of 40,000. The place in 47, when I came, could hardly have been called part of the mainstream of American life. Now you go across the street, there's a bagel shop. Well, in 47, nobody would have known what a bagel was. The Sunday New York Times arrived at the Union desk Tuesday noon. Okay, we had some trouble with our stove in the apartment, which was a university apartment. And my wife called the housing office, this was a new stove. And the fellow was really quite, the repairman was quite put out with her, and he finally said to her, you've never used an electric stove before, have you? And she was about to say, that's right, I only used the gas stove, she wanted, but before she could complete the sentence, fellow said to her, well, that's the trouble with you Southerners. You're used to wood-burning stoves. And of course, my wife wouldn't have known what a wood-burning stove was. So and most of the faculty prior to 47 was really drawn locally. They were people from Michigan and Wisconsin and mostly the Midwestern states. But with the great expansion, you had a national component added to the faculty as well as to the student body. And people came from New York and Massachusetts and California and so on, which gave the place more of a national flavor. Illustrations of Hannah's pragmatism. When Truman, President Truman, talked about point four, which was the export of American know-how and technology to the underdeveloped countries, as we called them then. Now we call them euphemistically developing countries. But in those days we were more descriptive. We called them underdeveloped countries. Hannah thought that we as a university, we as a college, we're still called that, had a role to play in it. He said, well, you know, part of the land-grant philosophy is teaching, yes, research, but research that should be put into the hands of the people who could put it to use. He said, well, we have a role to play in Truman's point four. And that added an international dimension, primarily to the work of the people in agriculture, because, they had something useful to contribute. One of my prejudices, which I will confess, is that economists don't have much to contribute. But the agriculturalists did have something to contribute, you see. So, he moved with the times, you see.
Do you think he actually suspected his university would be 40,000 something?
I don't think he gave it a thought. In this sense, I compare him to Franklin Roosevelt coming in with during the Depression with the alphabet agencies, the New Deal, and his attitude always was, let's experiment with it. Let's try. If it works, let's go with it. If it doesn't, let's be honest with ourselves and try something else. Okay. So it was the experimental, pragmatic attitude rather than a fixed blueprint that was to be implemented at any cost. Hannah was viewed by the faculty, certainly, as a Republican. And as somebody who was in with the powerful interests in the state, and obviously Michigan dominated by the big three automobile makers, the Kellogg's and the Dow's and so on and so forth. But Hannah said, well, yes, we as a land-grant institution have served the agricultural interests of the state. But you know, there are all these labor unions. And maybe there's some knowledge in the university that can be put to use on behalf of working people. So we established the Labor and Industrial Relations Center, you see, which everybody thought was far out. They couldn't understand why Hannah would do that. Conservative, Republican, etc., etc. Why the hell would he want to fiddle with something like that? But he did. And we had all kinds of extension courses for labor skates all over the state, you know, where people from this Labor and Industrial Relations Center would have extension courses taught to these people. This was a pragmatic adjustment to an evolving situation within the state.
Did you say an evolving need of the state?
An evolving need, which he perceived, you say, and to which he responded. And again, if you had asked him in 1945, let us say, do you think we're going to have an international dimension? He probably hadn't thought of it. Or are we going to supplement the agricultural extension with the labor extension? He probably hadn't thought of it, you see. But he had a shrewd perception of what the needs were out there in the state. And this all fit into the land-grant philosophy, of course, you see. But he implemented it without making any pontifical speeches on the subject and so on. He just went ahead and did it, you see. Did he have a coherent philosophy? I couldn't answer the question. But certainly, when you look at the things he did in context, they added up to a very coherent and consistent philosophy, you see. This was pragmatism at its best, I think. Okay, I mean, obviously, I'm stating only my reaction and my opinion.
Let me ask you this. On one side, I can see the logical extension of a pragmatistic approach, but at the same time, I can see someone else saying it's elitist. The idea of the development of the Honors College, first at Michigan State. And
well, I think first we have to talk about the basic college.
Okay.
And this was innovated before my time. I think it started in 1944. And the notion was, this was done under the influence of fellow by the name of Reeves, R-E-E-V-E-S, professor of education at the University of Chicago. And I don't know how Hannah hooked up with him. But this notion of general education, Hannah thought that was a good thing. Yeah, we're specialized in agriculture and this and that, applied fields, but people ought to have a general education.
Would a modern term for that be a cultural background or a cultural, common cultural education? Like
yes.
Kirsch is talking about.
Yes, I think that's a fair way of putting it. Originally, it started with six departments, but it ended up with four. But essentially, there was a history of civilization, which really meant Western Europe, the history of Western Europe. The humanities course, basic science course, and a writing course. And this really was experimental, and as I say, they started with six departments and they ended up with four departments. And that eventually became the model for many other universities. So every student who came to Michigan State had this broad background.
Just started talking about the...
the basic college, yeah.
We should throw in that Michigan State's ahead by 6 points because Dr. Wallenfeld will want to know that.
Okay. Well, they so we had the basic college, and of course the so-called upper college was complaining about the basic college. They said, the engineers said, we need more time for the applied engineering courses. We can't squeeze the curriculum into 4 hours. The English department argued, why shouldn't we be teaching freshman writing, why give it to, and so on. And they said, the quality of the basic college is really not up to the standards of the upper college, the upper division. So, a lot of pressure was brought on the question of quality. So the Hannah said to the provost at the time, he said, well, how do we respond to that? Right? Again, he had no preconceived ideas. And the provost at the time, I think, was Hamilton, and who was the University of Chicago person. And he said, you know, Mr. President, it might be a good idea to have something like an honors college. We serve the sons and daughters of the agriculturists and working people, but a gesture toward academic excellence is not incompatible with the land-grant mission. And so, that sounds like a good idea to me. Why don't we try it, you see? Mm-hmm. So again, that's how the Honors College came into being. And I quite agree with that. I don't think the two are inconsistent. The faculty, when it was concerned about quality and said, why don't we have a faculty that's as distinguished as our football team, Hannah said to the provost, it is alleged, well, how do you get a good faculty? And the provost said, you recruit them the same way as you do a football player. Well, a serious effort was made to, in the recruiting, to emphasize not only teaching, but research and publication and national and international distinction. The point is that the alleged conflict between excellence and scholarship being inconsistent with a teaching mission or excellence in athletics being inconsistent with excellence in scholarship. I think these are artificial dichotomies. And Hannah sort of demonstrated that this is a multiversity. That is, you you can serve many different constituencies without interfering with some central notion of what the mission of the university is.
I had a professor I had interviewed about a month and a half ago when I was going through and basically was approaching with that person, you know, his feelings about Dr. Hannah as an administrator. And I brought up the University College, and he made the statement to me, oh, don't even bring that up on campus. There's a lot of hard feelings about that. And that intrigued me. Of course, that was the worst thing in the world you could do to someone who's trying to do a dissertation, is wave a red flag like that in front of me.
Yeah.
I became immediately intrigued. But I got the feeling in talking with others, too, that there is some feelings about that, but I'd really like to get into why, because...
Well, it's bureaucratic imperialism. I mean, for example, one of the courses in the basic college was social science, okay? Social science was supposed to be an interdisciplinary course that involved economics, sociology, political science, etc. Well, what do you suppose the attitude of the specialists in economics and political science and sociology was toward that course? They all said, we can do it better. The economics component should be taught in the economics department, the political science component in political science, the sociology component.
Really a turf battle, in other words.
Exactly. That's what it was. And of course, to some extent, to explain it in bureaucratic terms, to some extent, the central administration allocates funds to different departments on the basis of enrollment. Well, obviously, this is a way of fattening your enrollment if you teach the freshman and sophomore courses. Not that you want to teach them, but you want to get credit for the credit hours that are generated by those courses.
And so the graduate assistant can teach them.
You got it. In other words, the ideal, the bureaucrat's ideal, let's say, in economics would be you teach the freshman the basic course in economics to 500 students, okay? You generate enough student credit hours to get money from the central administration to reward you for that, and then how do you spend the money? You spend it on graduate education, teaching classes of 5 students, 4 of them Korean or Chinese, you see, because that's what the faculty loves to do. Okay,
mm-hmm.
So that explains the in my opinion, that explains the attitude to the basic college.
How would you then put together, the basic idea, it seems to me, of wanting a general education, a common core culture being taught at a university makes sense. How do you fulfill that mission and at the same time keep the bureaucrats from sabotaging it?
Well, when you have a strong president like Hannah, he, as long as he was here, nobody dared touch the basic college because they said, that's Hannah's baby.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
Mm-hmm.
So it was as simple as that. And people might gripe around the luncheon table and say, why the hell don't we teach the basic the basic college course in social science? But that griping had no consequence.
Mm-hmm.
But once Hannah was gone, the lid was off. I mean, the people who were battling for turf were liberated. And they eventually succeeded in killing the... as it was later called, the University College. And now it's there's a distribution requirement. That is, you have to take so many courses in the social sciences, so many in the natural sciences, so many in the humanities, but they're taught by the specialized departments, essentially. And that's one model. Many colleges and universities follow that model, but it isn't the general education model, which, as you pointed out, is being, now that we're abandoning it, other universities are discovering that this may be the way to go. Yes, sir. So this is one of the historical ironies.
Can you envision some way of possibly setting up in a university college that would be slightly different than the one now, the one then, I mean, that wouldn't need that person? In other words, it could stand on its own, it could survive by itself?
Well,
what would it need?
Well, it would need some consensus on the ideally it would need some consensus on the part of the faculty, but forgive me for saying this so bluntly, but sometimes when I listen to discussions by my colleagues, I feel that they're just a bunch of Rotarians with PhDs. I mean, their values are not
yeah.
not very much different. So
I have the same thing in secondary education.
Of course, it's ubiquitous. It's ubiquitous. I mean, what is the last thing educators talk about? Students. I mean, it's if you listen to a departmental meeting, I don't care where, which department, I don't care which university, they'll talk about faculty perks and faculty problems. But the last thing is the quality of education that is provided for the students. And it's I can imagine the. Executives at General Motors meeting, they may spend an inordinate amount of time on what can be done to shape up the executive dining room or improve the executive parking facilities or the jet fleet that the corporation has, and very little about the quality of the damn automobiles they produce. I mean,
and they're paying for it now.
Yeah, but this is the curse of bigness, you see.
In my research in the archives yesterday, I was reading a lot of stuff that Dr. Carlin had put together. And in 1967, he started pushing the idea of a four-year university college that would have its own program with its own degree. Do you think that might have, if he had been able, had been successful in pursuing that, do you think that might have done it?
That really would have created a little. Well, it would have extended general education for 4 years to a four-year span. Whether that was desirable or not, I have some doubts about that. But anyway, that never came to be. I think. Ed tried to do that in order to protect the.
It was clear that's what he was doing.
The basic college, but that really didn't have a chance of a snowball in hell because of the turf that, of course, the upper divisions were trying to protect. But there's one other element about Hannah. He was always accused of being dictatorial and autocratic, and to some extent he was. That is, he was in control. He was a hands-on manager. He may have consulted people and listened to people. His door was always open. That is, there was access. And I should say that I, by and large, was a critic within the university. And I was never intimidated by this image of Hannah as the dictator, because I had the feeling that Hannah's attitude was, if you had something to say, and if you thought it was in the best interests of the university, he was willing to listen to it and he'd be very tolerant, and you'd never be penalized for your views, however misguided he may have thought these views were. But if he suspected that you had a private agenda, that it wasn't the best interests of Michigan State that you were concerned with, then he was merciless. And that was good enough for me, you see. I can recount to you an incident that occurred. It was in the middle 60s, as best I can recall, maybe 64, 65. I was very active in the AAU, the local chapter of the AUP, the American Association of University Professors. And the first meeting of the academic year, we had invited Hannah to come and speak to us, and he did. And there were questions, and I raised a number of questions which were critical of administration policy. I now forget what the particular issue was. And at the end of the meeting, I walked up to shake his hand to indicate that there was nothing personal in anything I had said. And he turned to me and he said, "Well, for God's sakes," or something. He didn't say "for God's sakes." He didn't use those terms, but something like "for God's sakes. You've been around here long enough to know better than to ask those fool questions. What do you want anyhow?" I said, "Mr. President, you're not going to believe that. I'm sick and tired of the phony bureaucracy, the democracy that we now have at Michigan State. I want to go back to the good old days when John Hanna was the absolute dictator of Michigan State." And he sort of winced at that, and ruefully he said, "You know, you can't do it that way anymore." See? Yeah. But I meant it, because and again, I start as a Jeffersonian, you say. But in order to make a democracy work, it's got to be a real democracy, and you need a strong leadership with it, rather than having all the form but none of the substance of it. You can have a hell of a lot of committees which seem very democratic, but the superstructure gets so heavy that that eventually nothing is accomplished, you see. I look at the university. Hanna left in 69. He ran this place out of the old administration building, which is right across the street. He had 1.5 secretaries. He had Miss Jameson full-time, and in the latter years he had added half a secretary, Mrs. Mark. He had one assistant, Jim Dennison, who was his alter ego, who drafted speeches. He was like Sorensen for Kennedy, mm-hmm. Okay? He thought like Hanna. And he was in the background. He had no official status or power within the university. He was just Hanna's private assistant. And then again, in the late 60s, Hanna got a young man as a second assistant who prepared budget justifications for presentation to the legislature, a numbers man, a bean counter, you could say. But that was it. That was the team that ran this place. And you had a provost, and you had 3 or 4 vice presidents, maybe. Today, you have the big administration building over there, which looks like an IBM card. And the number of assistant provosts we have, the number of vice presidents we have, I mean, the proliferation of administrative titles and offices and so on. And I say this without reflection on any individual.
Oh, I understand. This seems to be a human.
I'm talking about the organizational
nature.
Problem. And I can't get myself to believe that the university is more effectively run now.
Because you have the same numbers.
We have the same numbers, and now there's more red tape, there's more paperwork. When you appoint an assistant provost, of course, he has to have a staff and so on and so forth. Notice, they took the big administration building and they filled it with people. Right.
Hmm.
Okay. And it's Parkinson's law having taken over. Of course, the more you proliferate the bureaucracy, the further you get away from the central objectives for which the organization presumably exists. To use Emerson's phrase, once we had golden priests and wooden chalices, now we have wooden priests and golden chalices. I mean, so, you ask, has education improved? Has, I mean, for the students, has scholarship improved? And all the things the university supposedly stands for. Everybody still invokes the Land-Grant philosophy, but I wouldn't want to ask them in detail to explain the meaning of it to me. it's getting to be more and more of an empty phrase, you say.
Yeah, I sadly agree, and it's scary. I made the comment, I think, in my written comprehensives that what we need in the 21st century is the Land-Grant philosophy.
Well, of course.
We need it desperately. We've got to.
And you see, and undergraduate education, especially, is being shortchanged more and more. Not only by this university, but it's a national phenomenon. Because what we like to boast about now, and I'm taking this as a phrase that trips off the lips of vice presidents and assistant provosts and what have you. We are the premier land-grant university, and we're a great world-class AAU research university. Well, the emphasis is more and more on the latter, you see, than on the former. And the most prestigious professor is the fellow who has a zero teaching load. And if he has a teaching load, the more advanced the graduate course that he teaches, the more prestigious the professor, you say. And I just have no stomach for it, and I should add, and I'm not trying to blow my horn here, but simply for your information, I don't consider teaching, undergraduate teaching, and research and publication inconsistent. I'll match my publication record against anybody in this department, you see. But I still feel the missionary zeal, which is very self-satisfying because of the response that you get from teaching undergraduates. My young colleagues say to me, why do you spend all this time on your teaching? There are no rewards for it. And my answer is, well, I don't do it to have my department head put a gold star on my forehead and say you've been a good boy, or because the dean or the provost or the president or the board of trustees or the people of Michigan will appreciate it. I do it for myself. call it pride of workmanship. Secondly, I do it for the students. They know the difference between somebody who cares and does his job well and the guys who are just functionaries who go through the formal paces. And no student of mine over the 43 years that I've been here has ever forgotten my name, and I would say 90% have not forgotten the number of the course that I teach. And they come back and they'll remember little things about the class, and some of them will say, you know, having taken that course, not because of the content, but the general attitude, has changed my attitude to life. I say to these young people, I say, I find that more rewarding than a few extra pennies in my paycheck. Say, that's what I'm doing it for, if you want to know.
Yeah.
Say,
I know exactly where you're coming from, because I feel the same way, and the irony is some of the things that I see out there, the ones with wanting the perks, you know, the principal that wants all these assistants so that he can sit back and
exactly.
and plot against you rather than do his yeah. job.
And then there are the takers and then there are the givers, you see, and they're not the same people.
Amen.
See?
Yeah.
And I feel sorry for them because I feel that they're missing something, you see.
That's an irony, because I genuinely feel they are. They'll never be happy.
No, because, I mean, the assistant professor who takes that attitude says, well, I'm doing it until I get tenure. And then he has tenure, and then he wants to climb the next step on the ladder, and so on. Well, that's an endless chase.
Yeah. That's the curse of money and that material status. As soon as you have it, it loses its value.
And fame too, you know. I put it to the test the other day for my own a few years ago for my own amusement. That book that you see over there, I published that in 1986, and I happened to have asked the Nobel laureate in economics, James Tobin of Yale, if he'd give me a blurb. And I said to one of my young colleagues after Jim Tobin agreed to do that for me, and I didn't tell him why I asked the question, I said to him, what do you think of Jim Tobin? You are roughly playing around with the same ideas that he is. And this young whippersnapper, an assistant professor who really had left no mark as yet in the profession, said to me, well, Jim Tobin made a contribution in his day, but he really hasn't done very much lately. So I said to myself, if he says that about the Nobel laureate in economics, what the hell does he say about me, you see?
Yeah, yeah.
So even the Nobel Prize isn't enough. Even that is fleeting, you see.
Yeah, it's all too fleeting.
If you got the Nobel Prize today, people will say, pump your hand and say, gee, great stuff, I'm glad to hear it, and so on and so forth. 5 years later, they'll look at you at some professional meeting and they'll say,
don't I know you from somewhere?
Yeah, what has he done lately? Yeah, now, so whether you talk about material rewards or fame or fortune, this is goddamn fleeting, basically. What you do, you've got to do it for yourself, see? Because it's satisfying to you.
The other thing that scares me is something I saw when I first came where I'm at now as the superintendent. I was reviewing the transcripts of some of my teachers just to get a feel for them.
Yeah.
I had not realized until a couple of years ago that what I had taken as normal, the university college that I was broken in under, was not the norm.
Not the norm.
And I saw one of my instructors who was a phys ed major, and this is the truth. All his coursework, all of it, was in phys ed.
Yeah.
There was no history, no English, no science.
Well, my
scared me.
Well, my students, you know, that I get every time I make an allusion to something outside of economics, and not esoteric stuff, I stop and I ask myself, do they know what I'm talking about? For example, I might say, automobile prices since the end of World War II. And then I stop and I say to the class, by the way, when did World War II end? And an honest college student finally came the closest, said 1947. Well, that's within range. But some of them can't place the Civil War in the right century. So that's what you're dealing with. So they're in desperate need. They don't get it in the high schools, obviously. And they don't get it in college either. So what is the hope of a democratic society of tomorrow? And this is the elite, presumably, that I'm dealing with, see? I mean, on a demographic basis.
You know, if it's any consolation to you, they're like that in Europe as well.
Oh, they're getting right. I was talking to a German girl yesterday, a very bright girl, and she's here studying American studies. That's her field in Germany. So I had a chat with her, and I said to her, tell me, have you ever read Faust, Goethe's Faust? And she said to me, no. I said, you haven't. Why not? She said, well, it's too long. I said, well, I can understand people not reading part two, but part one, I mean, that's a great classic. She said, we don't read that in the gymnasium anymore. Well, that's a German high school, for God's sakes. And I'm sure the same thing is happening in France and in Italy and the Lycée and the Liceo and so on. So,
I had an honors student from Sweden stay with us for years as an exchange student. And when he first got here, I don't know how it got started, but he and my wife got into a let's test ourselves on geography, because I think it probably started with her saying we're Sweden or something like that. And then they called me in and. I could not get over how little the two of them knew.
Yeah.
I was stunned.
Yeah.
And at the same time, it took me a month to get over that situation, because he wouldn't talk to me for a month. He was totally intimidated by the fact that I named every country and that he couldn't give me a country or a capital that I couldn't find.
Yeah.
And I just sat there and was like, but I'm not that bright.
Exactly. It's generational.
I wouldn't compete against this kid in high school if I was his age. Yeah. Yeah, I knew it, and he was intimidated by me, and I didn't mean to intimidate him. I wasn't trying to show.
No.
I just knew it.
It's
scary.
No, it is. So, you see.
Did you see that article in Newsweek just this week? A professor, and I'm not for sure which. Ivy League school he was at, but basically he was talking about people wanting universities to get to more general education, and he said, you don't understand, in order for us to teach a general education, we must first have it, and we don't. We're too busy writing articles and specializing.
And this was, you see, this was my criticism in the way of the basic college, that is, to the extent that, say, the social science course was supposed to be an interdisciplinary and integrative course, in a way you needed your best people to teach that. And perhaps some of that general education, the integrative aspect, ought to have come at the end of the specialized education rather than at the beginning. So these kinds, there were all kinds of problems with the notion of general education and the basic college and so on. But it was a noble experiment which I think served very well, and I spoke up against the dissolution of the
the university college, and I, well, they had public hearing, quote, public hearings, and I appeared, and I said to the provost, I said, you know, this reorganization, the restructuring, is the last refuge of scoundrels, because what they're doing is moving blocks around on an organization chart. But nobody asked the question, substantively, what will this accomplish, they say. And he said, you know, I agree with you, but the general sentiment seems to be, etc., etc. So, of course, they went ahead and did what they wanted to do. And it isn't saving any money, you see, except possibly their hope that putting freshman education into large sections with a professor giving a lecture and then having hordes of graduate assistants handling sections, that they're going to save money. See? That may be their motivation. But then, again, you know, and maybe because it was an era of growth rather than an era of consolidation, but in the Hanna days, there was an excitement. There was high morale, and there was criticism. I mean, again, I say I was a critic on specific issues, but I never had any reservation about Hanna's leadership. First of all, because I identified him with the university. I mean, he wasn't the kind of president who was here today and at Northwestern tomorrow and at Stanford the day after tomorrow. He was Michigan State. See? He had commitment. So given his commitment, it was easier for people down the line to make a commitment.
Mm-hmm.
But today, I mean, we're just a bunch of monks in our cubicles, and if our ass is always on parade waiting to be pinched, you know, we're renegotiating all the time. Who's offering me a better deal, say?
You know, but I sense
not
that
the way,
feeling.
That's not the way to build a great organization. And this doesn't only apply to this place.
Oh, absolutely.
And it doesn't only apply to academia, but it's
a universal concept.
It's a bureaucratic curse.
I sensed when I was here in 62 to 65 a sense of excitement, of a mission, of moving somewhere together as a team. I didn't feel it, and I have not felt it this time around.
No.
I feel a feeling of deep depression, bad morale.
There's no morale. There's no concept. The students, you know, just a little. Again, this is anecdotal and episodic. It isn't scientific evidence across the board. But I go to all the graduations when I'm in town, not for the sake of the students, but for the parents. I have the feeling that, you know, given the pomp and circumstance, this is the only thing they get a four-year investment into their worthless kids. Okay. So I feel I lend my body to that. And at the end of the commencement ceremony, the president says, and now let us all join in singing the alma mater. You will find the words on page 15 or whatever it is in your program. And I look at the graduating class. There isn't one out of 10 that knows the words of the alma mater. They have to open their programs and look for the words. More than that, I suspect that they don't know the words to the fight song, say, let alone the alma mater. As a matter of fact,
Banks sometimes... Banks in the Red Caesar, there's a school that's known to all.
Exactly. Yes. See, the Alumni Association has this and the words to the alma mater. On the last
I'm in the Alumni Association. I never got this. I'd love that.
On the last,
thank you very much.
On the last day of class, I distribute that to the students. See, now, I get them as juniors and seniors. They don't have a clue. Well, to me, that's an index of identification, of affiliation, a sense of belonging, family, morale, call it what you will. See? And of course, they don't have it because we don't have it. You see, these things filter down.
Yeah. And it's funny because my son, who's 5, is wearing Michigan State outfits and he knows he's class of aught 8.
Yeah.
You know? I hope that by the time he's there that the feeling will be recaptured.
Somewhere here I think I had. Once had the, this is the music. I once had a copy of the old song when it was on the banks of the Red Cedar, etc. And it said, and those farmers play football.
Oh, they used to still, U of M used to still do the, you know, Moo You when I was here.
Oh, yeah. Well, they still do that. And I still sing the old words. I don't say, go right through for MSU. I still say, go right through that line of blue.
Well, I'll tell you, as soon as I saw that first line again of MSU, we love those shadows. The boy just.
Yeah, it's. You can keep that.
Thank you very much.
Well, what other questions, if any?
I'm at the point now where I'm at system overload.
Okay.
You've said a lot of very good things very succinctly. And I was sitting here thinking, as you know, how your mind will drift for a second. I couldn't have had a better interview if I had planned questions. I did exactly what I was told to do, and I'm glad I did it.